First, dealing with mass incarceration in the United States has become a bipartisan issue. Republicans and Democrats came together last year to pass what was hailed as the biggest piece of criminal justice reform in decades. It was legislation that earned the support of groups as different as the American Civil Liberties Union and the Tea Party group Freedom Works. But our next guest says that when it comes to policy debates about mass incarceration, both criminal justice reform advocates and supporters of a tough-on-crime approach have gotten some things wrong. And he says if we want to make real reforms, we need to better understand the facts and figures related to the criminal justice system. Peter Wagner is the executive director of the Prison Policy Initiative. He's also the co-author of the group's latest report, Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie, 2019. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What was your goal in producing this report?
We wanted to get the big picture on the number of people who are confined in this country, why they're there, and in what kinds of facilities.
And what are the challenges in gathering that data?
Well, it's the biggest challenge is that we actually don't have a criminal justice system in this country. We have a federal system. We have 50 state correctional systems. We have 3,300 county jails and about 25,000 local police departments, all of whom that collect their own data that may or may not be available or compatible with other data that's collected.
And what do you think the impact is on trying to formulate appropriate and accurate criminal justice policy when the data is so difficult to put together?
It makes it hard to put your resources of time, money, or attention into the things that actually matter. So the federal system gets lots of attention, but it's actually only a tiny portion of the number of people who are locked up in this country are locked up in a federal prison or under federal law.
What are some of the other types of facilities that we see so many other people being detained in?
Well, the biggest one is state prisons. So the 50 states lock up people for committing who have been convicted of violating felony laws in each state. That's the majority. And then one out of every three people who are locked up on a given day are locked up in local jails. Typically, they're accused of violating a state law, but they're being held by local authorities, and they're either just been arrested, or they're being held because they're too poor to make bail, or they were a very small number were convicted of a minor offense and then are serving a very short sentence. So jails are about a third of the population, but they get almost none of the attention in the national discussion.
So just basically, I don't want to throw a lot of numbers at people, but kind of in a proportional way, percentage-wise, how many people are in, say, state prisons or in local jails or federal prisons or other facilities? Because there are also juvenile detention facilities and also tribal facilities.
Correct. So the biggest slice is state prisons. That's more than half. That's about 1.3 million people are in state prisons, and about 600,000 are in local jails. And the federal prisons that get all that attention, that's only about just over 200,000 people.
And I just want to make sure that because we're going to be talking about them in different ways, can you break down in simple terms the difference between a jail and a prison?
Right. And this is really hard because in normal language, you and I might use these words interchangeably, but the statistics that are collected are, for the most part, use these terms really precisely. So state prisons are facilities that are run by state governments, and that's where people go after they're convicted of a felony of a serious offense. So typically people serve a sentence of a year or more in state prison, and every state might have one or more state prisons. But then jails, these are typically run by counties, and that's where the police send you when you are arrested. That's where if the judge says, you need to come up with a few hundred dollars before I release you under bail before your trial. If you can't afford to do that, that's where you stay. And that's also where you stay if you're convicted of a minor offense.
So it sounds like in prisons, there are people that are probably there for longer and on more serious charges and have been convicted of more serious charges.
Correct. And then the people in local jails are either been convicted of very minor offenses, or they're not been convicted of anything, and they're still considered innocent under the law.
We're talking with Peter Wagner right now. He's the executive director of the Prison Policy Initiative. He's the co-author of the group's latest report, Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie, 2019. And looking at the graphs in this report, and you all did a lot of really deep digs on the data, state prisons really jump out as having the biggest prison population. Is that true across the country, or are there some states where that's more or less true?
That's pretty much true everywhere. State prisons are a bit bigger than local jails. There will be some variation from state to state, but generally speaking, that's the pattern seen everywhere.
And who is running those prisons? Because I know the issue of private prisons has come up a lot as kind of a lightning rod issue. And what are we seeing as far as who's running the prisons, where the majority of those people who are incarcerated are spending their time?
So 90-something percent of all of the state prisons are run by state governments. Now, for a tiny portion, about 6%, the state prisons subcontract this business to private prisons. They send incarcerated people to a facility that's run by a private company, and the state then pays that private operator on a per-day basis to lock people up. But that's about private prisons are a very tiny portion.
And has that stayed relatively stable as far as what proportion it is in the last decade or so?
It's been pretty flat for the last decade.
Another thing that you see in your report is that the majority of people in local jails, as you said, haven't yet been convicted. What is pretrial detention and how long does it often last?
So pretrial detention can last a matter of hours before you are hauled before a judge and then released on your own recognizance, or you're asked to pay a certain amount of money to buy your freedom until your trial, and you can afford to do that. Or it could last all the way until your trial, which could include you pleading guilty to time served months later, or it could mean you stay in prison for months or years and then the charges are dropped or you're found not guilty.
And what about those people who start out in local jails, are there for whatever amount of time, and then do go to trial and are convicted? Do they usually stay in the local jail, or do they then become part of that population that's in, say, a state prison?
So when someone is convicted, they are then typically, if it's a serious offense, if it's a felony, they are then sent to a state prison to serve the rest of that sentence. If it's a minor offense, they stay in the jail.
And who decides that?
Every state's laws are different, but it typically will flow automatically from whether the offense is a minor misdemeanor or whether it's more serious and a felony.
We're talking with Peter Wagner, the executive director of the Prison Policy Initiative. We're talking about their latest report that provides a comprehensive look at mass incarceration in the United States. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about what the data actually shows about people imprisoned or in jail? Do you have ideas of what incarceration is about? We'll be talking about some of the myths surrounding that. And if you've had experience with the criminal justice system, does this align with your experience or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about mass incarceration in the United States and looking at whether some commonly held beliefs about the issue actually square with the facts. Peter Wagner is with us from the Prison Policy Initiative. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How does what we're talking about square with your beliefs about the criminal justice system? Are you surprised by how small a role private prisons account for in the system? What types of crimes do you think we should reform punishments for, and what types of crimes do you think we shouldn't? If you work in the criminal justice system, maybe as a police officer or inside a jail or prison, call in and share your thoughts about reform and what your experience is like. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Peter, turning to why people are imprisoned, you lay out five different myths. The first is that releasing quote-unquote nonviolent drug offenders would end mass incarceration. Walk us through that and why it's a myth.
Sure. It's that the number of people who, there's about one out of every five people who are locked up yesterday are locked up for a drug offense. So if we were to change all of our drug laws in this country tomorrow, that would mean dropping our prison population by about 20%. That's a big reform, but it by itself wouldn't end mass incarceration. So we just need to not overestimate the effects of the drug reforms that most states are starting to embrace, because they're only going to go so far.
As I recall reading through the report, there's also the issue that often drug offenses are not standalone offenses. They're often paired with other, they're one of maybe four or five charges that someone is facing. So would that 20% be significantly less, even if we eliminated people who just had a nonviolent drug offense?
That 20% actually includes the people who have just a drug offense. Because of the way the government keeps their statistics, if you are convicted of two different offenses, you are counted as if your only offense was the quote-unquote more serious one.
We did talk a little bit earlier about the how often private prisons come up in discussions of criminal justice reform and mass incarceration. You share that it's less than 10% of the prisons that are in the country. But why do you think those types of institutions have taken such an outsized role in these discussions?
I think it's a couple of reasons. One is that it's shocking to people that they exist. And I also think it's kind of convenient for the system to put more political pressure onto a little corner of the market and not look at the question that it's state policy that's driving the number of people who are incarcerated. It's state policy that's sending people to private prisons, and it's state policy that's paying this bill. It really kind of distracts sometimes from the discussion that we need to have about governmental priorities.
Is it something that you were able to uncover in this report, the cost per prisoner in, say, a state prison versus a private prison where a state correctional department is sending prisoners?
We didn't do that in this report, but generally speaking, if it's an equivalent facility about of equal age, it's about the same, because that's how profit works in this country. The private prison makes a bid, and they offer to charge basically just as much as the state would have to pay itself, and the difference is then the private company's profit. So the state doesn't save any money, or doesn't save any measurable amount of money, gets less quality, and gets nothing for it. So it's not a savings.
But it's also probably not more than they would pay for having that person in their own facility.
Right. It ends up being about the same.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. John in Brookfield is up. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to call and kind of offer an insider's perspective. I actually am a police officer, but I won't identify my department for, I'm sure you understand why.
Sure.
Typically, so there's a large misconception that the state prisons and nationally prisons are overpopulated with what you'd say the marijuana user or the weed user, as we'd say. And I think we believe that's a big misconception, because typically we will rarely arrest, or that will rarely ever be charged. It's normally associated with, it could be a weapon law offense or some sort of other violent crime or possible drug dealing where that type of charge may come into play. But typically, it's very hard to get that charge itself charged unless there's a long history and there's more to it than just that itself.
So it sounds like a one-off arrest for someone who has not been arrested before. If they are found with marijuana possession, chances are they're not going to be charged.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like I said, in a large city, you will rarely ever see charged.
Great. Thanks for that call, John. Peter, is that any surprise to you?
No, that's a really important point. So of the people who are in prison right now for drugs, only a very small portion are in for marijuana. Now, it's going to vary from state to state and locality to locality, but for the most part, marijuana offenses are not what's steering people to prison. And this is important to bring up because people will, not only will people say, oh, if we end the war on drugs, it'll end mass incarceration. People say, if we legalize marijuana, it will end mass incarceration. No, it won't. Of course, what the war on drugs does do when people get arrested, even if they're not sent to prison for it, it gives them a criminal record, makes it harder for them to get a job, for them to get housing, kind of sets people on a path to fail later. But that's totally correct that marijuana arrest is not driving the incarceration system.
Thanks for that call, John. We're talking with Peter Wagner of the Prison Policy Initiative about their recent report looking at mass incarceration in the United States. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. And Peter, another myth that you address in the report is the idea that prisoners are working basically as slave labor in prisons. Can you unpack that for us?
Sure. There's this big assumption that, and in the myth in the news, that lots of people, that most people in prison are working for outside companies for pennies a day. Turns out only a very small number are working for private companies or are working for state factories making office furniture or things for college dorms. That's pretty small. Most of the jobs that people have in prison are either busy work or are doing maintenance in the facility. And of course this pays pennies. This is a problem, but it's not the profit motive that's fueling judges' decisions or parole board decisions. That's kind of a distraction.
Are there laws governing whether incarcerated people can opt out or opt in to that kind of work, or are they in essence made to work for those pennies on the hour or the day?
Typically, the work that people do is compulsory. You don't have a choice.
So, Peter, the fourth myth you looked at has to do with community supervision. That's things like parole and probation. And, you know, that has been a very big issue politically, a political football, if you will, that, you know, letting people out on probation or parole, you're just giving them license to reoffend. What are the facts about people who are released on parole or probation?
Well, the facts are is that, in general, most people who are on parole or probation succeed in some way, but a tremendous number of people fail who are on probation. So probation is an alternative sentence instead of prison. Judge says, I'm going to sentence you to 2 years of being on probation, and you're going to be under some, have to check in periodically, and you're going to be under some supervision. But the really disturbing thing is that every year 100,000 people fail, quote-unquote, on probation and are sent to prison not because they committed a new offense, but because they violated some technical rule of their probation. So you failed a drug test or you're late to a meeting with your probation officer. And that's a real problem because we have people, it's kind of the system sets people up to fail by saying, oh, you have to do all these things and you fail in any of them, we can send you to prison. That's 100,000 people last year were sent to prison for violating a technical rule of their probation. And that's something that states could just choose to stop doing.
Our colleagues at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism did a very in-depth look a year or two ago at the challenges of being on electronic monitoring when you live in a place that may not have reliable cell coverage, which the monitoring bracelet relies on to be able to send the signal to say where you are and if you are where you're supposed to be, and that often set people up for those technical violations.
Right, that's a tremendous problem where we have a system that's marketed as an alternative that actually is nothing more than a system that funnels people into incarceration via this little side chute called electronic monitoring. But then we set people up to fail, make it so that they can't apply to jobs, violate them, and then steer them to prison. That's completely unnecessary as a policy matter.
Lastly, you challenged the idea that people who committed very violent or sexual crimes cannot be rehabilitated, and that keeping them in jail, base or prison, as long as possible is in the best interest of the public. Walk us through that. Tell us what we know about people who have committed, say, murder or rape and have been imprisoned and served their time.
that these are the groups of people that, once they're released, are the least likely to reoffend for the reasons of the type of offense, because they're all there for all kinds of reasons. So federal government data shows that only about a quarter of the people who are released for violent offenses in general are then rearrested for similar offenses within 3 years.
And how does that compare with people who are in prison and serve their time for what I think in the general public we would think of as less serious crimes?
So let's say like drug offenses that we were talking about before. Half of all people who are released from prison for a drug offense are rearrested within 3 years for a similar drug offense. But that is, the rate is, it's twice as good. It's 25% for people who were convicted of violent offenses.
So you're talking about people who are reoffending, which is also called recidivism. What are some of the challenge in trying to analyze data about people who reoffend?
There's some real big differences to how we collect that, how the governments collect that data. Is it arrest? Is it conviction? Is it within a certain number of years? You know, I think there's a real big difference between someone who is released and commits another offense 30 years later and someone who does it 3 days later. And I think there's also a real difference to whether or not it's a similar type of offense. If someone is released from prison and then 5 years later they have an open container, that is significantly less harmful to society than another violent offense. And we kind of have to need to acknowledge that in the data. And for the most part, most of the data that the government collects doesn't do that.
And Peter, what are some of the big lessons you think policymakers and the public, for that matter, should take from this report?
They need to identify the one thing that they think they can reform right now that would make a big difference, and then get moving on that. And as soon as they succeed on that one, find another one.
And what would you, if they came to you and said, okay, we're going to work on first thing first, what would that first thing be?
I might suggest bail reform and changing the way in which people are required to pay money in order to be released before trial, because that gets the number of people in jail down. It makes it easier for people to participate in their own defense and potentially not be convicted. And there's really no sense in America to be making people pay for their freedom. And again, given that most people who are in the criminal justice system are poor, there's really no reason to do that.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Peter Wagner, Executive Director of the Prison Policy Initiative. He was with us today to talk about the group's new report, Mass Incarceration, The Whole Pie, 2019. You can find their entire report and the graphics breaking down the incarcerated population in the U.S. over online at wpr.org/centraltime. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.